We're talking about the sexual lives of young men on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Please note, this hour is sensitive. It's teenagers and sex, but the discussion will not be explicit, but just take care. For over 2 years, journalist Peggy Orenstein spent time talking with boys, dozens of teenage boys, 16, 17-year-olds up to young 20-somethings. She met them in towns and cities straight across our country. And these interviews were quite a departure from our previous work. She'd spent more than 25 years chronicling the lives of girls and the contradictions that young women face in their intimate encounters. There is space for you to talk this hour at 800-642-1234. What messages about masculinity did you get growing up? How do you think that's affected your life? And parents, what is that journey like to raise a son who is socially and emotionally intelligent? Join in, 800-642-1234. Peggy Orenstein is the author of 7 books, and her new one is called Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn, Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity. Peggy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was surprised that you approached boys in these interviews with a bit of trepidation, with a bit of doubt, because you had spent so many years talking about these difficult topics, these deeply personal topics with girls. Why did you approach the boys with a bit of reluctance?
Well, you know, for one thing, teenage boys don't exactly have a reputation for chattiness the way that teenage girls do. And I was a little bit worried that I would have entire transcripts that would consist of, nope, you know, which didn't happen at all. So I didn't know what I'd have to say. I didn't know if they would talk to me, but I also, in thinking about it, felt really strongly that nobody was talking to boys and nobody was hearing from boys about these topics in a new era. And so I wanted to have real conversations with real guys about real issues. And I talked to over 100 guys across the country, to hear what was going on with them, because it's a new era now. And especially after Me Too, you know, that created this imperative to reduce sexual violence. But it also felt to me like it created a real opportunity to engage guys in, you know, these conversations authentically about sex, about intimacy, about masculinity in ways that, you know, we really never had before.
Let's focus in on one of those, masculinity. There are a lot of socially acceptable ways now for a girl to be a girl or a woman to be a woman. Mm-hmm. You don't have to fit in a box anymore. And you've watched that evolution, but it's not really the same for boys. What's considered, you know, masculine? Why is that so narrow? And why are boys often on guard?
Well, yeah, there's, you know, feminism has given girls many ways to be a girl. And boys, you know, I will say, of course, they now see girls as, you know, deserving of their place in the classroom or in leadership or on the playing field. But when I would ask guys, I'd do kind of a lightning round and say, tell me what the ideal guy is. And it sounded like they were channeling, you know, 1955. It was all about dominance, aggression, athleticism, sexual conquest, and emotional suppression. It hadn't really changed much at all.
Where do you see that's such a contradiction? Because you found them to be, you know, have some really modern ideas about girls and women and their place, and yet they were still, as you say, holding on to some really age-old ideas. How is that contradiction there?
Well, you know, I guess in a way, when I thought about it, it didn't surprise me that much, because after working with girls for so many years, the central thing that I was looking at with girls was the contradictions that they were facing in the modern world and the way that we had layered a lot of new expectations, many of which were, you know, positive and wonderful, over the old ones without really examining or getting rid of the old ones. And it was creating this tension in girls. And I was seeing the same thing in boys, because they were, the thing that was amazing about the boys, in addition to the fact that they really wanted to talk, which surprised me, and how, you know, because they so rarely are asked to, was how self-aware they were. And how, you know, they were really wrestling with these issues. So they would talk a lot, particularly about that emotional suppression piece, that stoicism. And they would talk about how they had to learn how to, you know, to build a wall between their real feelings and the world. And they would say things like, I trained myself not to feel, or I trained myself not to cry. There was a boy that I write about that couldn't cry when his parents got divorced. And so he streamed three movies about the Holocaust back to back. You know, that worked.
We're talking with Peggy Orenstein. She's an author and journalist. Her latest book is called Boys and Sex, and it's based on dozens of interviews with young men all over the country. What do you wish you could tell your younger self about sex and relationships, intimacy, or masculinity? What do you wish had been different? Is there someone you really looked up to? Who do you think is a model there for healthy masculinity? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Peggy, what is it like for these young men to cry? Do they cry?
Yeah, well, as I was saying, no, that was something that they would say, I trained myself not to cry. And I think what we're talking about here and what was very much at the heart of this book and why I started by talking about these masculinity issues instead of, you know, diving right into sex, is that it was about vulnerability. And it was about boys wrestling with the taboo that they felt against vulnerability, you know, denying it, deflecting it, capitulating it to it, embracing it, yearning for it. And I really thought a lot about how when we cut boys off from that emotional vulnerability, we not only cut them off, you know, from a basic human trait and need, but, you know, Brené Brown, the sociologist, says that vulnerability is the emotional vulnerability is the secret sauce that holds relationships together. So we undermine their capacity to attain and sustain the very kinds of mutually gratifying, personally fulfilling relationships that we want for them, which obviously affects them, but it also radiates out in all these different ways and affects their romantic partners, how they learn about sex, how they approach women.
You found that these boys confided in the women in their lives, their sisters and their mothers and their girlfriends. Why do you think that is?
Well, that was really interesting. And it was why in the end I felt that being a woman doing this work was valuable and perhaps an advantage, because boys can drop that mask. If they drop it with anybody, it's going to be with the women in their lives. It feels safer to you know, boys would say things to me like that they preferred to work with a female partner in a school assignment because they could be, you know, they could ask for help more easily from a girl. When they confided, they tended to confide in a girlfriend, in a female friend, in particularly in a mother. And I thought a lot about that because that can feel, and I tell the story of a boy who broke up with his high school girlfriend when he was in college. You know, she cheated on him or whatever. And he said, you know, and so I just forgot about her. But he didn't. You know, he stopped being able to do his schoolwork. He couldn't focus. He wasn't going out anymore. He was depressed. And he couldn't really reckon with that. He tried to go to a school counselor, but he said it was weird to talk about feelings. And finally he went home and he said, I had a breakdown in front of my mom. And she said, you know, spill it. And I think that feels very sweet to mothers to be able to be there for their sons and to have their boys express that emotional vulnerability. But the risk that I think we have to be careful of when that happens is that we process boys' emotions for them rather than helping them learn to do it themselves. And I think as women, we know that can feel very sweet with a boy. But when you get into an adult relationship and you still feel like that is the role, when we're teaching boys that women should do emotional labor, you know, it's not so sweet.
Talking with author Peggy Orenstein about boys' sexual lives, really hearing what these teenagers have to say. Her new book is called Boys and Sex. Your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the sexual lives of boys and young men. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Please use your discretion this hour. This conversation may not be appropriate for everyone, but there won't be anything explicit. And the fact is, parents often don't speak frankly with their sons about sex. According To a study in recent years in the Journal of Adolescent Health, 1 in 6 teenage boys, 1 in 6 say they have never had a single conversation with a parent or teacher about contraception or disease protection. So parents, what were the most difficult aspects of talking to your child about sex? If you haven't had those discussions yet, what do you hope to get across to your son when you do? Join in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Author Peggy Orenstein's new book is called Boys and Sex, and she stays with us. Peggy, last year, the American Psychological Association released guidelines for working with men and boys, saying that men and boys who are socialized to value traditional masculinity, they often suffer negative health consequences. What are the consequences of internalizing these messages for boys and men?
I'm still thinking about what you just said in your intro about talking to boys about how parents talk to boys about sex. I hope we'll get to that, but yeah they because you just hit that they, if they talk to them, it's risk and danger. Internalizing some masculine norms is strongly associated with being more likely to sexually harass, being more likely to bully, but it's also interesting because it's associated with harm against themselves as well as harm against others. So higher rates of not only committing violence, but being the victim of violence, binge drinking, car accidents, depression, fewer friends. You know, there's a lot of pain inside of what we call the man box. So expanding boys' emotional range beyond that is not only something to be doing, you know, it's something to be doing for themselves. And again, you know, it's about improving their relationships, improving their mental health, improving who they can be as human beings, letting them be their best selves.
Yeah, let's look at bro culture and locker room talk. Many of the men you spoke to said they valued gender equity, they valued LGBTQ rights, but they reported, you know, that they also seemed to change who they were when they were in these male-dominated spaces. What was happening there in the locker rooms?
Well, you know, again, the way that guys learn to talk about sex and the way that they learn absent that, it's particularly absent that discussion from a caring adult or from schools, is a kind of culture of conquest. And as a way to bond with other guys and prove their heterosexuality through the control of women. And so how do they talk about sex? They hammer, they nail, they bang, they pound, they pipe, they hit that, they tap that. You know, it's like they went to a construction site, not like they engaged in an act of intimacy. And it wasn't like the guys that I was talking with necessarily felt good about that. And I think a lot of times a lot of boys in the room don't feel good about that. But they need a lot more discussion and support and thinking about how to disrupt that. So one of the boys that I spoke with, Cole, talked about trying to challenge boys on his sports team who were saying something, you know, despicable about girls. So he and a friend said something and they got mocked and they got targeted. And so the next time it came up, Cole didn't say anything, but the other boys still did. And he said, I watched. Well, the more that guy stepped up and the more I stepped back, the more he was, you know, the other guys didn't respect him. They stopped liking him as much. He lost his social capital. And there I was sitting with buckets of it and not spending it. And he was actually going into the military the next year. And he said, I don't know, you know, what to do because I don't want to have to choose between my dignity and this unit, these guys that I'm going to serve with. But how do I make it so I don't have to choose? So I felt in thinking about that story, you know, that there's this silence in which boys learn masculinity. Part of it is about what you don't say, what you can't say, what you won't say, that creates this restrictive nature of how you're supposed to behave and who you're supposed to be as a guy, even if it's not who you really are.
We're talking with Peggy Orenstein. She is an author and journalist. She's been studying the lives of girls for more than 25 years, and in recent times, her focus has been boys and young men. So men and boys, do you feel you're free to express your emotions, or do you feel repressed in that way? Are you a parent to boys? Do you parent them differently than you would girls? Join in with your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Peggy, you say that when boys are caught engaging in this kind of behavior, like the high school boys in Berkeley who posted sexual comments about their female classmates, a lot of times they say that they were just trying to be funny, just trying to fit in. And it seems like a really poor excuse, but they were just trying to be funny. But is that really true?
Yeah, I got really obsessed with the word hilarious, the way that boys today use the word hilarious. And it's another way that they learn. They use it as kind of a deflective shield because it gives them, if something is inappropriate, if it's confusing, if it's depressing, unnerving, or especially if it combines the sexual and the aggressive, the sexual and the taboo, and it's, you know, they know that it's upsetting or gross or icky or whatever. If you say hilarious, you're always okay as a guy. You know, nobody's going to mock you. Nobody's going to target you. But it's also a way, under the kind of pretext of that horseplay, that disconnects boys from, you know, disconnects head from heart, disconnects head from conscience, and subverts a kind of more compassionate or empathic response to whatever is the subject of that hilarity. And at the far end of that spectrum, yeah, what you find, I got really interested in every time there was an act of sexual misconduct among high school boys that would hit the news, whether it was some kind of, you know, sexting scandal, or whether it was like the Steubenville rape. What those boys said was, I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was being funny. So there's a way at that, you know, at that far end that it becomes this deflective shield for behavior that is truly, you know, harmful to others.
Yeah. So this rape and sexual assault case in Steubenville, Ohio, where a boy was captured on video saying that the rape of a girl at a party wasn't funny. It was hilarious.
Exactly.
What can we learn from that type of situation?
Well, that a lot of these issues that we talk about them in this kind of broad strokes way. And I think there's a lot of nuance and a lot of understanding. I mean, it's very important, you know, to me to talk to boys in a way that doesn't demonize or stigmatize them, because that shuts them down, but helping them to become aware not only of, you know, like what you said in the beginning of this intro was, you know, parents aren't talking to their boys about contraception. They're not talking to boys about disease protection, but they're also not talking to boys about the power dynamics that they learn through socialization and that girls learn through socialization, and the ways that those affect them and shape the way they go into their intimate relationships, whether that's something like hilarious or the fact that when guys go into a party situation, and particularly when they're drunk, they tend to overperceive yes in girls, like perceive any act of friendliness as yes. They tend to not be able to see no as easily when they've been drinking, and to not see a partner's hesitation. And boys need to be really made aware of the ways that they learn and the ways that the culture tells them messages about male sexual entitlement and female sexual availability.
What can drinking do to perception of what yes means yes and no means no?
It can just make it very hard for people to see. And what we know about hookup culture, which is the idea that some kind of physical intimacy precedes emotional intimacy, and rather than deriving from it. And that's what kind of the culture is on a lot of campuses. So a relationship comes from a hookup, but most hookups don't lead to relationships. And in order to, I call it, you know, how kids talk about catching feelings, like it's a disease, you know, like you catch chlamydia, you catch gonorrhea, you catch feelings. Mm. These things must be guarded against. And so to avoid the chlamydia and the gonorrhea, you're supposed to wear a condom. To avoid, and they do and they don't, you know, but to avoid catching those feelings, you want to put on your emotional condom. And the way you put on your emotional condom is you drink. And so alcohol becomes, Lisa Wade, who wrote the book American Hookup, calls it necessary to create the compulsory carelessness that kids need in order to engage in a hookup, or to engage in sex with somebody they don't know. And so when that happens, you have to find somebody who is drunk enough to be able to say yes. And you have to yourself be drunk enough to be able to say yes, but not so drunk that they can't consent. And really, you know, who is to be the judge of that?
We're talking with author Peggy Orenstein, who has spent more than 2 years interviewing high school and college age men about their experience of physical and emotional intimacy. Out of that is her new book, Boys and Sex. It's a follow-up to her book, Girls and Sex. Are you a parent to boys? Do you parent them differently than you would girls? How so? What have you told them about growing up and becoming a man? Can you talk about sex? Join in through the hour, 800-642-1234. Email ideas, WPR.org. Back for more conversation with Peggy Orenstein here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for an hour-long conversation about young men and sexuality. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for joining us. Author Peggy Orenstein's new book is called Boys and Sex. And so, as the book title suggests, we're talking about a sensitive topic, which is young men, emotional intimacy, and sex. So please take care. Peggy writes about how mothers are more likely to talk with their sons about intimacy, but not as deeply or as broadly as they do with their daughters. The book Boys and Sex is a follow-up to her book Girls and Sex after she spent decades documenting the lives of young women and girls. Parents, do you struggle with the task of raising a boy who is socially and emotionally intelligent? What does that even mean? How do you broach the subject of relationships and sex? Join in throughout the hour, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us, WPR Mornings, and author Peggy Orenstein stays with us. Peggy, one of the young men you talked to said that his parents always told him to respect women. Then he said that that's like telling someone not to run over any old ladies when they're driving and then handing them a set of car keys. Was that a common response?
Yes, it was. That's my big joke. You just took my punchline. yeah, that's what it was. It was such a great line. He said that, you know, my parents told me to respect women, but yeah, exactly that. That's like saying don't run any little old ladies, and handing a kid the car keys. You don't think you're going to run over any little old ladies, but you still don't know how to drive. And that was the most, what boys tended to be told by their parents was, don't get anyone pregnant, don't get a disease, and respect women. And while that was never an adequate set of messages, in our current cultural climate, where on one hand, boys and girls, of course, are just steeped in a highly sexualized media, both mainstream media and pornography, and the other hand, they're met with adult silence on trying to understand that and trying to understand the culture and the rules and the joys of sex and relationships, that really leaves them ill-equipped. It puts them at risk. It puts them at risk of causing harm and of being ill-equipped to have the kinds of relationships they want to have.
How significant is the role of parents here when it comes to addressing these issues, to talking about sex?
Well, if parents don't talk about it, you know, they're going to be educated by the media, basically. Those are your choices at this point. And I don't think that you're going to like the result. So I don't feel like we have the luxury of silence. And in the last chapter of the book, I really, and this is the first time I've done this in a book, and Girls and Sex, I did the writerly thing of showing and not telling and talking about a classroom that was kind of doing the job. But this time I really stepped out and talked about a series of conversations. It's not the talk, you know, it's not the talk. It's a lot of little conversations that have to do with media, that have to do with gender dynamics, that have to do with sex, but not only sex, with consent, but not only consent. And I feel like it's kind of like, you know, if you were teaching your child table manners, you wouldn't sit them down and say, all right, fork goes on the left. This is how you hold it. Don't burp at the table. Say please. Say thank you. And when you get up, make sure you say that you're excused from the table. And then say, okay, go forth into the world. We've had this talk about table manners. We never have to address it again. You know?
That will go down. Right, yeah.
Right. Like, how many times do you have to tell your child to say thank you? And you're still doing it when they're 30. And so our interpersonal relationships are at least as important as our table manners. And yet, you know, we have learned that at best, we give a tiny talk about risk and danger. And I know it's hard. I know you would rather poke yourself in the eye with a fork than talk to your son about, say, oh, I don't know, pornography or female pleasure. But, you know, again, I was hoping that this book, in surfacing the voices of the boys, which are so much at the heart of the book and of the conversation, would allow parents to see what's in guys' minds that would help them to have those conversations and frame those conversations. But I also really wanted it to be a tool for young men themselves, for older high school boys, for college boys, so that they could see, you know, themselves reflected, so they could ponder this, and maybe they could open, you know, get beyond the guy talk and open a more meaningful dialogue with the boys in their life, and maybe even just in their own heads.
Filling the gaps here, how are schools doing in having these conversations about sexuality and sex education?
That transcript would be filled with huh. yeah, so they're not. You know, again, states are still stressing abstinence, which, you know, abstinence is a legit choice, absolutely. Not if it's a mandate, and not if you're comparing sexually active teenagers to chewed pieces of gum or used pieces of tape. And, you know, regardless of when your family values, say that you would like your child to enter into an intimate relationship, whether that is, you know, when you perceive them to be ready, when they're in love, when they are married, they still need this information. They are still steeped in this, you know, in a highly sexualized media that keeps projecting images of male sexual entitlement and female sexual availability. They still are going to be exposed to pornography, all of these things. And so we still have to have these conversations with them about, regardless of when they enter into it, or whether it's for 5 minutes or 50 years, what constitutes a mutually gratifying, personally fulfilling, reciprocal relationship.
We're talking with journalist Peggy Orenstein about her new book, Boys and Sex. It explores masculinity, intimacy, relationships among boys and young men. And boys and young men, what kind of messages do you feel like you get about masculinity? What do you feel is expected of you in order to be considered masculine? Or do you want your parents to talk to you about sex and relationships? Where do you find openings, even though it may feel really awkward? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Peggy, you mentioned porn, and there is a lot of hand-wringing, distress over porn consumption and how it's becoming so much more mainstream. And there's also an association in this consumption with a greater tolerance for harassment, some belief in rape myths, earlier onset of sexual behavior. What should we know about the media out there?
Yeah. Well, and that's those traits that you just mentioned, those results are not just from porn. Those are from consuming basically any media. So we do a lot of hand-wringing about porn, but and I'll get to that in a minute, but as one boy said to me, you know, it's TV, it's video games, it's social media. One guy said, you know, music has a big impact on, he thought, on how guys treat girls. He said, when you're driving around with your boys in the car all afternoon and you're hearing some version of, let's, for family-friendly sake, say, Hit It and Quit It, 5, 6, 10 times a day, it affects your mindset. So talking about and giving boys a lens on mainstream media as well, and not just saying, you know, that's disgusting, but really helping them to critique it is super important. But porn, to get back to that, I always want to have a few caveats before I start that conversation, which is, you know, curiosity about sex is normal. Masturbation is important. And there's all kinds of porn. There's ethical porn, there's feminist porn, there's queer porn. But all that stuff tends to be behind a paywall. And what changed is not only the internet and not only smartphones, but the rise, but the dropping of the paywall on sites like Pornhub, which came online in 2007, which allows you to see anything you want and a whole lot of things you don't want on a smartphone 24/7. And, you know, if you have a teenage boy, they've seen that. And the thing is that when we're not in there talking to them about what's real and what's not real, that is their sex educator now. And it gives them these images over and over that are distorted of sex as something men do to women, of female pleasure as a performance for male satisfaction, of sex as conquest and as devoid of feeling. And again, that, you know, in general, invulnerability piece of men. So it's really important as parents, and again, you know, rather poke yourself in the eye with a fork, I know, but that we talk to them about what's real and what's not real and what's missing in pornography. Or, you know, they do bring those ideas in the bedroom, even when they say they know the difference.
You talked with queer and transgender young men for this book. Were their perceptions of masculinity and what is expected of them as boys and men, was that different from their straight peers?
Yeah, gay guys were super interesting for a lot of reasons. I mean, one thing, obviously it's a new day, right? We've got a gay man running for president, same-sex. These kids can't remember a time before same-sex marriage was legal. But they still, you know, they were still like, they were kind of like spies in the house of hypermasculinity, because especially the high school boys, you know, they were very conscious of how they walked, how they held their bodies, the pitch of their voice in order to fit in. So they could really describe, you know, what it meant to be an appropriate guy, even better than the guys who just sort of did it unconsciously. But one of the really cool things about gay boys was they were real models of negotiating consent and navigating the parameters of a sexual experience, kind of because they had to be, because what they were going to do together was not necessarily assumed. So who was going to do what with whom and how had to be talked about. And as one boy said to me, you know, I don't get the resistance of straight men to this conversation, because if we're talking about consent, it means we're going to have sex. You know, that's great. And Dan Savage, who's a sex columnist in Seattle, always talks about the four magic words that gay guys use at the moment of consent, which is, what are you into? And what I love about that is it's so open-ended. Unlike when we have the consent conversation with heterosexuals, where we presume a series of predetermined questions that a boy is usually asking a girl and she is saying yes or no to. So it's a really different way, a paradigm shift of what if we could have our kids ask those conversations, our kids, meaning not our little kids, obviously, but our older kids, and engage and answer those conversations and create experiences that were meaningful and mutually enjoyable for everybody.
We're navigating the complexities of sex, love, intimacy, masculinity. Author Peggy Orenstein is here. She's our guide. Her new book is called Boys and Sex. So where do we go from here on talking with our sons and daughters about sex? What influences do you see from films and social media? Are you concerned about your boys in the Me Too movement? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're having a conversation around sex and love, hookup culture, relationships, masculinity and media, sexual consent, misconduct, all of these things, all of it set against the backdrop of the Me Too movement that emerged as author Peggy Orenstein wrote her book, Boys and Sex. And if you're just joining us, we are talking about a sensitive subject, so do take care. It occurred to Peggy that after more than 25 years of doing extensive interviews with teenagers and about sex and girls, that the activism on behalf of girls could offer a model to better guide boys. So that's where we are today, with your questions, your insights, your solutions along the way. 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Peggy Orenstein stays with us through the hour. Peggy, how can parents talk about consent, specifically consent, and help sons understand the concept of yes means yes, enthusiastic consent, and what that really means?
Yeah, I think it depends on the age of your son. So that's kind of a big question. if you have a small child, you start with small lessons that aren't about sex at all. You start with saying things like, you need to ask permission before you hug somebody, and somebody needs to ask permission before they hug you. You know, just, is it okay to hug you? Is a lesson in consent. Or if Great Aunt Nancy comes over to your house and she wants to kiss your five-year-old and your five-year-old does not want to kiss Great Aunt Nancy, well, you know, Great Aunt Nancy has to suck it up, because that's a lesson in autonomy and sexual consent, that we get to make those decisions about ourselves. So, you know, as again, all these questions, they're about sex, but they're also not about sex. You know, they're about being a decent human being in the world. As boys get older, you can look at some of the stories that are in the news. Not, you know, we too often kind of do look at monsters and good guys. We look at the Harvey Weinsteins, where, you know, obviously monsters and need to be put away, but that can blind us to the kind of everyday kinds of coercion and misconduct that good guys can sometimes engage in, because, you know, good guys can do bad things. So talking about that, but I think, and understanding as adults, we need to refresh our ideas of what the contemporary definitions are of consent, because they've obviously, for the better, changed since we were young, and making sure boys know that. But again, talking to them as well about some of the ways that we socialize kids that can cause a kind of perfect storm. So, you know, I believe I said earlier that boys tend to overperceive. Yes, there's some research in the book that shows that asking guys about, you know, what they thought, you know, what was an indication that a girl was interested, the range was so great that most of the things were only mentioned once, and all they had in common was that the young man wanted to believe that they were indications that a girl was interested in sex. Talking to boys about the work in the book, the sociologist who looked at boys' definitions of consent and found they do understand it. But when she asked about their experience in their most recent hookup or relationship, a lot of them narrated experiences that, you know, were not consensual. But rather than look at their actions, they expanded their definition of consent. So the ways that boys can learn to filter through, you know, from the media, from girls themselves, from their parents, to filter female desire through the lens of their own wishes. Or female wishes through the lens of their own desire, female behavior through the lens of their own desire, is really important.
Peggy, after having so many conversations with boys about their deeply personal sexual lives and feelings, are you rethinking anything about how you understand girls and sex, how you write about girls and sex, or even talk to your own daughter about young men?
Well, I really, you know, I think that the books. Yeah, worked so well together. And for me, they just gave a kind of overarching idea of how we need to talk to girls and how we need to talk to boys. And I think it's really easy in this conversation not to see boys as individuals and not to understand that they grow up in a system also that tells them who they're supposed to be, and that can be hurtful for them, and that can then cause them to cause harm to others. And I think when I think of the books together, I feel like girls kind of systematically learn to be disconnected from their bodies and their desires. And boys are kind of systematically disconnected from their hearts. And when those things come together, it creates real inequality in personal lives.
Is there any hope that you see very quickly as we wrap up here? Is there anything changing?
Absolutely. And, you know, First of all, the big takeaway is talk to your kids. And that's exciting. But the most exciting thing to me with the guys themselves was their own desire for something more expansive. And they're wrestling with a lot of these issues in ways that their fathers never would have, in ways that I think 10 years ago, or maybe even 5 years ago, boys wouldn't have. And they were not just blank slates on which the culture was inscribed. They were thinking about these issues. They were struggling with these issues. They were pushing themselves on these issues. And that was tremendously interesting and exciting to see.
Peggy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This was Peggy Orenstein talking about her latest book, Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn, Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity. More people are being locked up in Wisconsin, and the increase in inmates in the state's jails and prisons is costing taxpayers more money. A new analysis of state data by WPR found significant increases in jail populations since 2015. Rob Mentzer reports.
During a recent tour of the Oneida County Jail, a man who'd just been booked was there coming down from the drugs he'd been using. Jail staff had him in restraints, and the man could be heard calling out.
Let's head this way first. On something.
So sooner down here, then we'll figure out.
They're keeping a close eye on that.
It's not rare for people who get booked in the jail to have medical needs. Jails have become used to dealing with people who are facing withdrawals from opiates or the lingering effects of methamphetamines. Oneida County Sheriff Grady Hartman says dealing with the effects of drug addiction has become the norm.
4 or 5 years ago, I never really thought we would have, our community up here in the Northwoods would have a lot of methamphetamine and heroin use. I never thought we would have overdose deaths.
The increase in inmate population has put a strain on many local jails. The number of jails placing inmates in other counties has been steadily rising in recent years. In the first half of last year, more than 40 jails typically had inmates in other facilities.
We built the facility in 98, and then in 2009, we started to outgrow the facility.
That's Sheboygan County Sheriff Corey Raisler talking about Sheboygan's detention center. It regularly exceeds its recommended population of inmates, and that can force some difficult decisions.
We just don't have enough single-cell space in order to accommodate those needs when people come in off the street and they're under the influence of some intoxicant or drug, or they might have a medical and mental health issue, but which would preclude them from being placed in the general population.
During a tour, Brinkman says some of those inmates do end up housed with others in a less secure area of the jail.
And this area of the facility fills up faster than we'd like it to, so we're forced.
Governor Tony Evers campaigned on a promise to cut the state's prison population in half. A report from the state showed that it grew by about 8% from 2011 to 2018. Reversing that trend was always going to be a challenge, and there's little evidence of progress. In fact, state prisons are so overloaded that the state regularly pays county jails to take inmates. Oneida County, which has more space than it needs in its detention facility, contracts with the state to take about 100 prisoners at a time. Sheriff Hartman says Oneida County officials drive a four-hour round trip from Rhinelander to Stanley, Wisconsin every week to exchange inmates. But he says in many ways, the state prisoners are easier to manage.
As headaches go with inmates, we have significantly far less headaches with a state inmate than we do with a county inmate.
The county also earns about $1.2 million per year from the state in exchange for providing housing. The money goes to the county's capital budget. Legislative efforts to reduce the jail population haven't gained steam in the state capital. But Milwaukee Democratic Representative David Crowley is one of a group of legislators focused on the issue. He's introduced a bill to limit bail jumping charges, which are used to incarcerate someone who's violated a court order, for example, drinking alcohol if a judge has ordered them not to, as a separate case proceeds through the courts. System. In 2018, more than 8,000 people in Wisconsin were charged with felony bail jumping. Crowley says someone can be found not guilty of the original charge, but still be prosecuted for violating an order like that.
But because you were guilty of bail jumping, now you're doing even more time than the original charge.
Crowley's proposal has bipartisan support, but it's not clear that will be enough to get it a vote. Earlier this month, Governor Evers called a set of Democratic proposals a first step toward criminal justice reform. The next day, a group of Republicans announced a legislative package they called, quote, tougher on crime initiatives. Those bills would increase some penalties. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.